Good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure for Gillian and I to be here tonight and to share with you some thoughts about the last week of Christ's life and to fellowship with you. So we're doing a consideration of this section of Mark chapter 14 tonight. The parallel accounts are in Matthew 26, Luke 22, but we'll probably stay mostly, at least as the focal point, in Mark. So we have this situation where Jesus has just taken part in the Last Supper with his disciples, with the apostles, and with his friends. And Judas has gone out, and as it's expressed by John in his gospel, Jesus says to him, go do what you have to do. And John says, and it was night. And so begins the ignominy of Judas's actions. And we see those consummated here in this section of the text that we've just read tonight. So there's a darkness descending upon the Lord as he's coming to the point where he is facing his death. And we not only have the betrayal of Judas, but we also have the falling away of the disciples. And so Jesus says, he gives this commitment or this prophecy about what Peter is going to do. And he quotes from Zechariah as proof of what's going to happen. So they've gone out to the Mount of Olives and they've sung hymns, and now they've come down to the Garden of Gethsemane, which is how it's described in verse 32. They come to this place, the Garden of Gethsemane, and the word Gethsemane means oil press. It's just at the bottom of the Kidron Valley, just down from the Mount of Olives, and I would imagine the view that Jesus would have had, interestingly, as he was in that garden, was he would have had a view directly in front of him of the temple wall. And that was what he would have seen. And we know that just a couple of days before, he had given his prophecy on the Mount of Olives, and he had seen the temple in all its glory and spoken about its demise and its destruction in AD 70. But at this point in time, it's like he's looking up at that temple and he sees everything that it symbolizes, and it just represents this wall that has become a wall between man and God, because the temple is no longer the place where God dwells, but as Jesus has said, your house is left to you forsaken and desolate. At the end of Matthew 23, he makes that statement. So Jesus is there in Gethsemane, and just before this, he said these words, you will all fall away, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. This is verse 27 of chapter 14. And that's a prophecy taken directly from Zechariah, a quotation taken directly from Zechariah. And any time Jesus quotes something from the Old Testament, I think it's a good idea to go back and take a look at the context for what he's saying. Because as many times when he will quote just a fragment of what he's thinking, and you're left to fill in the details. One of the examples there is in Luke chapter 4, when he goes and he stands and he reads from Isaiah's scroll, and he gets halfway through a verse, and then he sits down and says, this day this is fulfilled in your ears. And he stops right in the middle of the verse. And if you go to read on the rest of the verse, it gives an indication of what he's going to do in the future in terms of his kingship. And I think that's part of the reason why the people were marveling at what he said on that occasion. This is another one of those cases, I think, where Jesus quotes from part of the passage in Zechariah, but he doesn't quote the whole thing. But he's got it in his mind. And we're going to take a look at that a little bit later on. We're going to look at the rest of the phrase in Zechariah 13 and see what the implications are in terms of what he was thinking about. But for now, let's just focus on his mention of the term, you will all fall away. So we know what happens to Peter. Peter says, even though they all fall away, I will not. And yet he ends up denying his Lord. So in that sense, Peter himself fell away. His denial was a falling away. And if you look at verse 50 of this chapter, you'll see that it says, they all forsook him and fled. So I think all the disciples fell away. So I think the important thing here to realize is that Jesus, in quoting from Zechariah 13, is not just making a generalization, or he's not just expressing what he thinks might happen, but he's stating what absolutely will happen, that they will fall away. Now, it's not just falling away in the sense of they forsook him, they ran away, because the word fall away is, it's translated in the King James as offended, and that's really most often the way in which the word is used. It's the word scandalizo in the Greek, and it's the same word as the word for stumbling block. It's the verb form of the noun, stumbling block. So to fall away means either to sin or to lose your faith. And I think in this case, whether or not it was a sin, you could definitely say that they had lost their faith, because Jesus was not the man that they thought he was at this particular point in time. They were ready to go to die for him. I think Peter was absolutely earnest and sincere when he said, I'm ready to die for you. He said, if I must die with you, I will not deny you. But the problem was that Jesus wasn't asking them to die with him, at least not in the way that they wanted to die. They wanted to die in a military way. They were ready to have a full-on attack and confrontation with the Romans and with the authorities. And so Peter was ready to wield a sword on behalf of his master. And if you think about it, that's the way that men, young men, very often are. They're ready, foolishly often, to barge right ahead into war and to lose their lives in the heat of battle. But when it comes to something that has an impact on their very soul, the courage is not necessarily there. And so a lack of understanding and a lack of courage to stand up for his Lord, I think, caused Peter to deny his Lord in the way that he did. As I say, we don't want to pick on Peter, because although the incident about him warming his hands at the fire and denying Jesus with the maid present, although that's recorded in detail for us, I think exactly the same things were happening for the other disciples, who also end up falling away, stumbling. Let's look at another use of that word stumbling. In Mark chapter 4, verse 17, there's a parable that I think we're all pretty familiar with. It's the parable of the sower. And so one of the places where the seed fell, verse 16, these in like manner are the ones sown upon rocky ground, who when they hear the word, immediately receive it with joy, and they have no root in themselves, but endure for a while. Then, when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately they fall away. And it's exactly the same term that Jesus uses. They stumble, they fall away, they desert the faith. And I think it's interesting that Jesus uses this parable, because I think usually when we read this parable, we think, oh, somebody falls away and they're gone. But we know in the case of the disciples, although they fell away, at least most of them came back, right? In Acts chapter 1, all 11 are there, actually, so all of them came back out of the ones he was speaking to. So to fall away doesn't mean you have to fall away forever, but certainly it was a loss of faith on their part. And in that sense, they stumbled. So in that sense, they fulfilled the prophecy that Jesus had spoken about. And that prophecy, as I said, was from Zechariah chapter 13. Let's go back now and take a look at that, because it's quite remarkable what is written there. And I think when we look at the whole verse, there's some interesting implications for us. So, looking at verse 6, we know that chapters 12 through 14 of Zechariah are all concerned with the last days, but there are these jumps back to the death of Christ, or the time of the death of Christ. And so verse 6, "And if one asks him, 'What are these wounds on your back?' he will say, 'The wounds I received in the house of my friends.'" And so you can see immediately how the prophecy is related not to what the enemies of Christ did to him, but to what his friends did to him. And so it goes on to say, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man who stands next to me, says the Lord of hosts. Strike the shepherd, that the sheep may be scattered. I will turn my hand against the little ones." And that's the verse, the section that Jesus picks up, is "strike the shepherd that the sheep may be scattered." And in this case, the sheep, the shepherd is Jesus. He is being struck. The sheep are his disciples. They are scattered. And interestingly, they are also described in this prophecy as the little ones. Earlier in the verse, though, this is the part I'd like us to think about now, is the phrase, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man who stands next to me." So a couple of points here. First of all, the phrase, "the man who stands next to me," the word there in the Hebrew is the same word as the word "neighbor." And it generally only occurs in the first five books of the Bible. It occurs in, I think, Deuteronomy and Numbers. And it also occurs in Leviticus. And I'd just like to read you this passage from Leviticus where it occurs, because I think this is quite interesting. Leviticus 19, 15 through 18. "You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. Thou shalt not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, but in righteousness shalt thou judge thy neighbor. Thou shalt not go up and down as a talebearer among thy people, neither shall they stand against the blood of thy neighbor. I am the Lord. Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor and not suffer sin upon him. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord." So that section of text from Leviticus 19 makes several references to the neighbor. It's the same word as the word "the man who stands next to me." And we know that that's one of the key texts that Jesus quotes in the New Testament. It's one of the two great commandments, right? Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And it's that same word. In fact, the whole context of Leviticus 19 is interesting, because it has to do with what's going on inside your heart, not just the externals. You know, a lot of times we think that the law only dealt with externals. That's sort of the standard line that we come up with about the law, is that the law was about ritual and externals, and Jesus was about the heart. Well, that's not exactly true, because we can see here that the law was about internals as well. The difference was that Jesus brought those principles out in a much greater measure and greater strength. And so Paul was able to describe in Romans the law as being holy and just and pure. It's not as if God created a system that was inherently wrong, but it was a system that had a limited impact and a limited effect, and all it could do was be a guardian for us to bring us to Christ. But the law in itself wasn't wrong. And so the principles here embodied in Leviticus 19 are picked up by Jesus and expanded on when he says, this is one of the greatest commandments, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. But the interesting point here is who is speaking in verse 7 of Zechariah 13. Well, it is God who's speaking. So he is standing next to his neighbor. He is standing next to his only begotten son. And so the sword that is going to fall is the sword from God's hand that is going to fall on the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay, just bear that thought in mind, because now we're going to do a little study of the use of the sword in here. So let's take a look back at Mark 14. And this was really the thing that got me looking at this in a little bit more depth. Back in Mark 14, the disciples are sleeping and Jesus comes back and he says, you know, why are you sleeping? Could you stay awake? We're familiar with that. And in verse 41, he says, he came to him a third time and he said, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. So Jesus says there, it is enough. And what did he mean by that? What do you think is likely that he meant when he said, it is enough? Anybody want to venture a guess? No? Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, I think Harold's idea is probably the sense of it, that he has finished through the trial of experiencing the temptation of wanting the cup to pass from him. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about Jesus' use of this prophecy. That's another point that we're going to get to in a minute. But now let's take a look at Luke chapter 22, verse 38, because the same language is used. And Jesus basically tells them in verse 37 or the earlier verses that they're going to have to start fending for themselves, because I tell you that this scripture must be fulfilled in me, and he was reckoned with the transgressors. And that was the part that they didn't understand. They didn't understand that Isaiah 53 had to be fulfilled and that Jesus was about to be treated like a criminal, not like a political rebel or a political or a military figure, which is what they expected. And so they said, and I suspect this was Peter who said this, although we're not told explicitly, verse 38, they said, look, Lord, here are two swords. And he said to them, it is enough. Now, what did he mean by that? In this particular case, well, I think he meant something very similar to what he meant in the Mark reference. It is enough. No more of this. I'm done with this, is would be sort of the vernacular term that we would use today. You know, put this away. It's enough. We're done with it. And if you can see over in verse 50, one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear, but Jesus said, no more of this. And he touched his ear and he healed him. It's exactly the same idea as it is enough. And we know from John's account that this was Peter who did this, who cut off the ear of the servant of the high priest. And the servant's name was Malchus. I believe it was Michael Ashton who, from this platform actually, when he spoke here about 10 years ago, made a connection between Malchus and Melchizedek, saying that Malchus sort of represented what Melchizedek was, but unfortunately, he worked for the wrong guy because he worked for Caiaphas. And Caiaphas was the guy who essentially ratified the wrongful conviction and the murder of Jesus. Because it was Caiaphas who said that it is expedient for one man to die on behalf of the nation. And so basically said, you know, let's give up Jesus, because if he dies, then it's going to keep the peace between us and the Romans. That's essentially what Caiaphas was saying. So an interesting connection there. But anyway, this phrase, "it is enough," is interesting, because why did Jesus say this? Well, I think one of the reasons he said it in a practical sense, as we know, was he was not going to go out and fight against these people. In fact, he says to them in verse 52 of Luke 22, he says, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you did not lay hands on me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness." And so he essentially says, I'm going to go willingly. I'm not going to fight with the sword, because that's not the way that I'm going to win the victory over sin and death. So the sword of God was hanging over Jesus in the garden. That was what we've seen from that citation from Zechariah chapter 13, the passage in verse 7 again. Just read that again. "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man who stands next to me, says the Lord of hosts. Strike the shepherd, that the sheep may be scattered." So while the sword of God was hanging over Jesus and he had to go to the cross and experience handing over his life and sacrificing himself on our behalf, the sword that was in Peter's hand, cutting off the ear of the servant, was doing absolutely no good at all. And so Jesus heals the ear of the servant. Let's go back now to 2 Samuel chapter 24, because this phrase, "it is enough," comes up in this passage. So 2 Samuel 24 is kind of an interesting chapter. I'm actually confused about it, and maybe somebody can enlighten me on this. This is the passage that we sometimes use as a proof passage for Satan not being a supernatural being, because it talks about God inciting David to number Israel, and the parallel passage talks about Satan inciting David to number Israel. And the problem, of course, is that when David goes to do this, Joab tells him, "No, you shouldn't do this." But David goes ahead and does it anyway. So I can't really figure out what the sin of David is here. I suspect it is that it was a sin of confidence in the numbers of the people, of the army, instead of placing his trust in God. Or it was possibly a sin that he thought he was going to be able to raise more taxes as a result of taking a census of the population and finding out how they were. Does anybody else have any other ideas about what the sin was here, or any thoughts on that?
Or he didn't collect the tax he was supposed to collect and go with it, because it was supposed to be so much per head, which was actually a lot of money.
Yeah, that's... I think that's probably a pretty good explanation. Anyways.
That's in Exodus 30, isn't it? Exodus 30, 14.
The collecting the tax? Is it? Okay. Thanks. So that everybody hear Bob there? It's in Exodus 30, verse 14, where you collect the tax. So regardless of what it was, David had committed a sin, and then he was remorseful about this. Okay, verse 10, David's heart smote him after he'd numbered the people, and he hands over his life, basically, or his care, into God's hands. And God gives him, or Gad gives him, three choices You know, do you want 3 years of famine, or do you want to flee 3 months before your foes, or do you want to have 3 days of pestilence? So David says, I'm just going to fall into the hand of the Lord. And I think that's kind of echoed by the writer to the Hebrews when he says, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And in this case, David says, his mercy is great, but let me not fall into the hand of man. So the pestilence falls upon them, and it kills 70,000 men from Dan to Beersheba. And then the angel, verse 16, stretches forth his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it. Now, Jerusalem was supposed to be the capital of Israel, and it was supposed to be the place where the temple was going to be built. And so at that point, God says, he repents of the evil and said to the angel who was working destruction among the people, it is enough. Verse 16. See the connection there with Jesus and Peter. Peter thought he was going to be the avenging angel along with Jesus, and that he was going to slay the wicked, the chief priests and the Romans who had come up against Christ. So he was like very much in a similar role to the angel who was here. This could be the same destroying angel that was the destroying angel of the Egyptians back in Exodus. It could be the same angel who was wielding a sword who stood in front of Balaam's ass. It could be the same angel who was there guarding the way to the tree of life with a flaming sword. So the angel of the Lord was, where was the angel of the Lord? He was by the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. Now a Jebusite was one of the native inhabitants of the land of Canaan that the Israelites were supposed to have wiped out, right? That like the Hivites and the Kenizzites and the Canaanites, the Gittites, the Girgashites, and so on and so forth. And he, it would appear from the meaning of his name, was that he was probably the king of Jerusalem. And Araunah does an interesting thing. He offers to give David the threshing floor where this takes place. Now, a threshing floor was typically on a high place because you would have a place where it was windy. It would be just a flat, kind of padded down surface, muddied surface that was hard, and a place where you could thresh out the grain, and the chaff would be blown away by the wind. So you can see there's all kinds of interesting symbols here. The threshing floor, we already know the parables that Jesus talks about of separating the wheat from the chaff. Another interesting reference is in Luke 22, when Luke gives the parallel account of what we've just read about, when it says that you will all fall away on account of me this night. In that case, Jesus says, Satan has desired to have you, and he will sift you like wheat. So there's a threshing process that goes on. In that case, Jesus is describing the temptation and the trials that the disciples will experience. The word you in the text there is the plural word. So it's Jesus desires, or Satan desires to have you and will thresh you, the disciples, like wheat and separate the wheat from the tares. And we know that Judas, of course, Satan enters into his heart, is how it's described in John. Meanwhile, Jesus says to Peter in that same reference, I'll just turn it up because I can't quote it from memory, so let me just turn it up and read it. 31, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you, singular, Peter, that you may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brethren. So Jesus knew that even though Peter was going to deny him, and Peter was going to fall away like the rest of them, he was going to turn again, and he would become a source of strength to his brethren. And in fact, Jesus goes on to encourage Peter three times to strengthen the brethren, three different occasions. So we've got this interesting symbol then of the angel, the destroying angel, at the threshing floor of Aruna. And Aruna then, he hands over the piece of property to David. And David says, well, no, I can't just take it that way. You know, I've got to give you something for it. And so he gives him an earnest of 50 shekels of silver. And then later on, he pays him another 600 to pay the full amount. In verse 25 of 2 Kings 24, we read that David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord heeded supplications for the plague, for the land, and the plague was averted from Israel. So on that occasion, God stayed the hand of the destroying angel and stopped him from wielding his sword on the people and for the pestilence to continue. Likewise, Jesus stays the hand of Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane and stops him from setting into motion something that could threaten the plan of God, where Jesus was going to go willingly and lay down his life on behalf of his friends rather than fighting for them. Of course, there's other parallels here too, right? We probably have already thought of the sacrifice of Isaac, that when Abraham goes to sacrifice Isaac, he raises his knife and God stays Abraham's hand. So there's another beautiful parallel there. The other interesting connection here is when we look over at 1 Chronicles chapter 3, I think it is. I've got this correct. For some reason, I don't seem to have the reference in my notes here, but that's not the right reference. Just check my notes. Second Chronicles 3, sorry. So Second Chronicles chapter 3. We see what happens to the threshing floor of Aruna the Jebusite. Then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to David his father at the place that David had appointed on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So another beautiful symbol there. This becomes the place where God is going to have his house built. And it's the same place where Abraham had gone to offer Isaac. And it's the same place, essentially, that Jesus is going to go and lay down his life. And we think about some of the prophecies that Jesus said when he said, destroy this temple, and I will rebuild it in 3 days. The parallels there to this. So there's some beautiful symbols here. The symbol of the threshing floor, as I've said, we can see a reference to it in the threshing of the disciples, but also the experience that Jesus goes through. That the trial of the Garden of Gethsemane must have been like wheat being threshed. It must have been an incredibly painful trial for him to endure, to go through that struggle in the garden against the temptation to walk away from it all. We know that he says, let this cup pass from me. And I'm sure that was a very real temptation for him. In that sense, what we see in the Zechariah passage is we see a complete fulfillment of that passage when it says, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. Because I think essentially the battle was won in the Garden of Gethsemane. That's not to take away from the subsequent pain and shame and humiliation that Jesus had to go through in the trial and the death on the cross. But I think the final inner struggle that he had to go through was essentially completed in the Garden of Gethsemane. And in that sense, God struck him. And Jesus humbled himself to God and gave himself over completely into God's care. I think that's really the essence of our struggle, isn't it? Our struggle is not an outward one with pain, but it's the inner one with the problem of sin within us. If we can have all kinds of external problems, but if our heart is not right within us, it doesn't matter how we handle those problems. We're not to be martyrs, and Jesus wasn't a martyr in that sense. He was a perfect sacrifice in that he willingly lay down his life. He gave up his will. So it was written of him, lo, I have come to do thy will, O God. Sacrifices and burnt offerings thou hast no desire, but I've come to do thy will. And I think that was the essence of the struggle that Jesus went through. And we can see it in the account of in Luke, where Luke describes, as it were, great drops of blood coming forth from Jesus. And his description in Mark that we read tonight, where it was, my soul is at the point of death. So I think it's the experience in the garden is a very beautiful one in that sense. And, you know, a few years ago, there was a movie out, what was it called? The Passion of the Christ, was it? Or is that the one, the Mel Gibson movie? Do you remember that one? And at the time, I remember I was determined that I wasn't going to go see it because really all it did was it glorified the violence that took place that was imposed upon Jesus. And it went on for great length, apparently. The scenes went on and on and on with, you know, him being flogged and with the crown of thorns and with blood running down him and with people just treating him, you know, kicking him and all these things. And yet, when you read the account in the Gospels, the account of that kind of experience that he had is very, very brief. And really, it's almost stated, I don't want to say matter-of-factly because I don't want to be disrespectful to the text or to our Lord, but it's certainly not glorified. The violence is not glorified and is not made a big deal of. But the inner struggle that Jesus went through, I think, is where the emphasis is. And we can see it in the Mark account, the Matthew account, that they go on at great length to describe how Jesus was struggling with the choice of whether he was going to go to the cross or whether he was going to take another route. And it's really kind of an echo of what happened in Matthew 4 in the temptations in the wilderness. Okay, so Jesus is then, finally, he is abandoned by his friends. And that must have been, I think, another aspect of what he went through that was extremely painful for him. And again, that was in fulfillment of Zechariah chapter 13. And that's another way in which Jesus, I think, gives us an example, because sometimes in life, we can experience times when we're let down by our brethren. And it's at times like that that we're reminded that ultimately we have to rely upon God, that he alone provides us with our comfort and our salvation. I think the experience of Jesus in the garden helps us to understand that. Another one of the beautiful lessons of Mark chapter 14, I think, is that even in the moment of deepest personal anguish, Christ cared for his disciples. So it was the ultimate example of putting others before self. I think we often allow our own personal difficulties to become an excuse for us being inattentive or ambivalent towards others, or to allow ourselves to indulge in a lower standard of conduct than Christ calls us to. Perhaps we're more short-tempered or quick to anger, or perhaps we're more self-indulgent, using the excuse that we're under stress. Yet no one was under more stress than Jesus, who was sweating, as it were, great drops of blood. Finally, let's take a look at Psalm 22, because there's another interesting reference to the sword here. Psalm 22 is another one of those passages that, you know, Christ is on the cross and he says these words, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And for some people, that's presented a problem over the years because they thought, how could Jesus say that, you know, and still really be faithful? But I think he was simply thinking those words and the rest of the psalm. The rest of the psalm describes the experience that he was going through in explicit detail. But the psalm ends in a very positive way. But the verse I want us to focus on is verse 20. Verse 20 says, deliver my soul from the sword, my life from the power of the dog. And if you have the King James Version there, I think it says, my darling, right? Does anybody have the King James? Does it say darling there? So the word darling is only begotten, or only the only one. It's the same word that is used when God says to Abraham, take thy son, thy only son, and take him up to Mount Moriah to be offered. So Jesus knew that his life was like that of Isaac. He was God's only begotten son. And his life was going to be saved from the sword of man. And his darling, his only one, him being the only son, was going to be saved from the power of the dog. And the conclusion of Psalm 22 is, as I said, it's very positive. And we'll just read verse 22. I will tell of thy name to my brethren. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise thee. So Jesus gains the victory over sin and death by succumbing to the sword of God that had to fall on him so that he could lay down his life for mankind. And he repudiated the sword of man in order to do that. Anybody, we've got about 10 minutes. Does anybody have any further comments or questions? Yep.
He'd done what God had asked him to do, and this is why he cried out on the cross, it was finished, and that's when he died.
Yep. I would agree with that.
That's the same phrase, and I believe in the last part of Psalm 22, when it says,
Oh, in verse 31, in mine it says that he has wrought it. So in the King James it says that he has done. Yeah.
He has done this.
Okay. Okay. Interesting.
So what it portrays is that he is man. He's tempted. He's struggling.
Right.
But we know, according to his own words and his master, God's his commendations, is that his will was his father's.
Right.
So without that expression of struggle, we might not actually truly appreciate how difficult it is to be human.
Thanks.
There's another interesting connection with the it is enough or enough. In Deuteronomy 3:26, Moses is actually standing on the mountain of God. He said, but the Lord was angry with me because of you and would not listen to me. And the Lord said, enough from you, do not speak to me of this matter again.
Oh, right.
And then, which is kind of cool, but then the next, in his next breath, he says, I charge Joshua and encourage him. The figure that's really wonderful when you start looking at that is that the contention with the law, which could not save, was allowed to see the land that was that Joshua, that Jesus that would lead them through, and it had to be done by the destruction of the law in that sense, and then Joshua leading them through. So another rather unique expression of that.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I had thought about Moses. I thought about David's sin of numbering the people. Moses' sin when he struck the rock and he said, "Hear now, you rebels," right? Was the sin of presumption and pride, it would appear. And that was the consequence of that is this passage right here where he gets to see the land, but he doesn't get to go into it. So that's interesting.
The only thing the same David when Moses struck the rock, he struck it twice and he shouldn't have done.
Right.
Because Christ could only die once. And he struck it twice.
Oh, that's interesting.
He shouldn't have done.
Okay. Right.
As long as the tithe was the component of that numbering, and the purpose of that tithe was for the work of the sanctuary, so the work of the preaching, the work of the temple, administration, all those things. And so the people didn't participate in it. And specifically in Exodus, the account says if you don't do this, there'll be a plague. So the people sinned. David, if you call it a sin, he does it in the form of putting the trial in front of the people, because he's the one who forces the circumstances. And I think he's more of a mediator role, like Daniel, Jeremiah. I think that somebody says, I've sinned.
That's a really good explanation. That, That one of the commentaries actually suggested that it was as much to do with the people sinning as David. But that, thank you. That's really helpful. Okay, thank you very much.